And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. We're heading into the first weekend in May. The weather forecast, not so promising, as you just heard Tracy say, but we'll live with that. After all, it's May, right? It's May. We have a good program, I think, lined up for you today. You know, yesterday we began our series of candidate chats, and we'll be doing that over the next week or so, leading up to the election day on May 21st, not too far away. Coming up later on the program today, we're going to be chatting with Deborah Stevens, who is one of the co-authors of it's a self-help book. It's been out for a while, but there's a new expanded edition. It's pretty good, folks. I'm not a big believer in a lot of self-help books. A lot of them are kind of abstract and goofy. This is pretty good. We'll be talking with Deborah Stevens about that a little bit later on the program. And also today, I'm sure there's a generation or two now that has no idea who William F. Buckley Jr. was. He was a conservative writer and a broadcaster. If you're old enough, you may remember him on PBS. Alvin Felsenberg has written a bit of a biography about William F. Buckley Jr. We'll be talking by telephone with Alvin Felsenberg a little bit later. First, though, we are going to be chatting with Matt Fisher, who is one of the candidates for judge on the Court of Common Pleas here in Butler County in the upcoming election. Matt Fisher, welcome. Nice to have you here on the program with us here today.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it.
You are going to be running for a vacant seat. It's to fill the seat vacated by Marilyn Horan, who was elevated to the federal court late last year. Tell us a little bit about your background. Some of our listeners will know you. Many will not. Tell us a little bit about Matt Fisher.
Well, Dave, I appreciate that. Thanks. What I would say is this, from a personal background, I'm 57 years old. I'm married 28 years to Marcia Fisher. She was formerly Marcia Paraska, born and raised in Butler. I have two children. My son Zachary is getting ready to graduate from Grove City College in the next week or so.
Wow.
And my daughter Zoe is in the eighth grade. We attend Community Alliance Church. Obviously, faith is an important part of my life. I have very strong conservative values, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment. Those values, along with my faith, have served me well, Dave, in terms of my marriage, raising my children, and frankly, in my practice. We deal in terms of family law. That's primarily where my practice is. And with we're dealing with families and people in crisis. By way of my background, in terms of a legal background, I've been practicing all but 30 years, primarily in family law, but I have a general practice, so mm-hmm. We're engaged in all different types of areas. I have appeared before over 110 judges throughout Pennsylvania. I've had about 4,000 trials and hearings. That experience, Dave, has provided me an opportunity to see what works and what doesn't within the context of a court setting. And actually, what I want to do is take those experiences, along with my life's experiences, and help the families, the people of Butler County when it comes time to elect a new judge.
I want to get you just a little bit closer to that microphone. That'll
Thanks.
Keep my engineer happy. Thank you. Thank
Thanks.
You, Matt. It's quite possible that the judge who is elected on the 21st will serve in family law court here in Butler County. That's not a guarantee, but it's quite possible. You think your background would help you in that area?
Well, Dave, my understanding also is that the next judge is slated to go into to family court. Again, there's no guarantee, but I think that's where we're going. But yeah, obviously my background of 30 years practicing in family court is really the key. I've been saying this, it's about time that Butler citizens have a family lawyer as a family judge. And by that, what I'm trying to say is that the nuances of practice of family court is important. And I think a judge having that type of specific background is going to be beneficial to the citizens. And no offense, the families in crisis. I don't know if you want me to expand on that, but
please do. No,
I appreciate that. Look, it's no secret that we have a drug epidemic. There's a crisis. And the concern that I have, and I think others similarly look at it, is that this drug epidemic is really going to the heart of families. It's hurting them. It's dividing families. And as a lawyer, I see this come when people come into my office. As a judge, what I want to do is take my experiences, okay, and try to provide some stability, some guidance, okay, so an opportunity to help these families move into sort of that next chapter of their life when confronted with difficult issues of divorce, custody, and support, or God forbid, even domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to law school, Matt Fisher?
Well, I hear that question, and if I can say it this way, education, I think all the candidates have had an opportunity to go to high school, college, and law school. We all passed the bar. What I like to tell people is this. My education in the legal sense, okay, is hands-on. It's in the courtrooms. It's 30 years of practicing, okay, in front of over 110 judges. That's invaluable experience. You can't learn that from reading a book and going to particular schools, okay? We can talk about, my education in terms of starting out in Catholic school and dealing with the nuns and the guidance that Father Cecil taught me, all through, my time, I had an eye accident as we were talking off the air at Penn State when we were visiting friends of mine. And my life story then took me to Ohio, up through Michigan, and then back to my hometown of Reading, Pennsylvania, before a young girl, Marcia Peraska, brought me to Butler since 1998. And so that's how I like to describe my education. It's really a life's education of experiences, values taught by my little Italian mom and my dad, and that continues today through my faith.
What made you want to become a judge?
Well, I think what happens is this in a very selfish manner. We've gone through the practicing all these years, and I think it's human nature that when you see situations, you take a step back, you pause, and you say, I think I can do something better. I think I can add to something. I think I can help people in a different or more positive way. I think the timing of this was a godsend. We have a son who's graduating, from Grove City College, so the financial situation there is a little bit relieved. But more importantly, Dave, is this. This is an opportunity to give back, to take my experience, okay, my values, and help people, in an area where, for 30 years I have seen what this type of chaos, crisis has on families. And I have ideas in terms of taking that to the bench and trying to help people in that capacity.
Do you think the drug problem, certainly the opioid crisis and other drug problems, is the main contributor to families in crisis these days?
It's not the only issue there, but look, with the drug epidemic comes collateral issues, crime, impact on families' lives. And we see, I see more and more today, more grandparents assuming roles of parents rather than their traditional roles of a grandparent. And why is that? Because the parents, okay, have been, afflicted with this disease. And for whatever their reasons, they can't rid themselves of these demons. And it's a new dynamic that is facing, I think, the family in our society. And I think the role of the judge here is to sort of get a grip on this and see what can be done to make sure that our children, the next generation, Dave, if you will, how are we going to provide stability for them? What is going to be the dynamic of helping them cope, with maybe not the traditional type of family? But a different maybe definition of a family as they have to deal with it because of, issues of drug or, maybe parental, malfeasance, if you will.
what would be one of the major areas where a family law judge would deal, like custody cases, for example, in a divorce or separation?
You're absolutely right, Dave. I mean, that's really the the family judge is going to hear divorces, obviously, mm-hmm. when husband and wife decide to go their separate ways. That's an obvious. Custody is, dealing with moms and dads who, for whatever their reasons, can't decide how they want to raise their child, and they need the court to intervene. You have issues of child support. Obviously, the drug issue that we had talked about a little bit earlier, that impacts it because if individuals aren't working, they don't have the ability to support their children. And then you have children doing without, and the court's role there is to help enforce the custodial parent, getting child support in order to help protect and provide, the necessities for a child. And then, lastly, we have the domestic violence, which seems, at least in the news, to be more and more prevalent. One can only wonder, is that a byproduct of, maybe the deterioration of morals? Is it a combination of drugs, alcohol, influencing people's decisions? But these are the issues that a family judge is going to oversee. And the ultimate goal there, Dave, is to bring some stability to that family structure, however you want to define that family structure.
Do you think it's the responsibility of a judge to try to have the parties come to an agreement among themselves before it has to go to court, or does the judge not get involved in that?
Well, I look at the judge's role as more along the lines of a referee. Okay, if in the perfect scenario, Dave, two litigants would have two lawyers, competent lawyers, who would be able to adequately advise and guide their clients. Okay, in the perfect world, people are always better served coming to reaching their own agreement rather than letting an unknown, a judge, if you will, mm-hmm. make decisions for them. Unfortunately, sometimes it's a necessity. And so the role of the judge is first to explore whether there are opportunities for common ground and resolution. And if not, then listen, okay, to what the parties bring. What are the facts? What are their circumstances? And then apply it fairly, as the law requires. And that's a significant role and frankly, an obligation that is we need the right people in the right positions to make good decisions.
What else would you like to tell people who are mulling over their decision about who they're going to vote for this vacant seat on the Court of Common Pleas? What else would you like people to know about you, Matt Fisher?
Well, look, Dave, there's four candidates, and each of the candidates is going to come and tell people what their views are and why they're the better candidate. All I can tell you is what I said earlier, okay? I'm a married man of 28 years, okay? So there's stability in my life. We've raised two children, one graduating from college, as I talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is an important part of my life. I have conservative values that I think have guided me well. My experience in the legal field, okay, is unquestioned. I mean, it's 30 years in family court, an unblemished record, and those are the types of background information, that I think people can resonate with in terms of, okay, is he qualified? And then I think we get to, the bigger issues, and that is, okay, does he have the temperament? And, does he have patience? Does he use common sense? Is he going to have some compassion? Dave, I tell you, if you have not been in the court setting, it is not a comfortable setting. People come there with all sorts of emotions, sometimes with unrealistic expectations, okay? And what is important that if you have access to this system, okay, you have to be free, you being you or the lawyer, the litigants or the lawyers, to be able to express yourself, tell the court what are the facts so that the court can hear it intently, listen, okay, and then apply the law. And I think what I'm looking forward to doing is making sure that the environment that these people, it's an uncomfortable environment, and no offense, you and I were talking on air, this is my first time on radio. And so I have a little bit of apprehension. Imagine what it is when you're dealing with real life issues that affect you and your children. And I think it's incumbent on the court to put the litigants at ease so that they can get the true facts and then make a fair and impartial decision based on the law.
Sometimes in criminal cases, and I must confess what I know about court cases is probably what I see in TV and in the movies, but in many times they rely on precedent in a criminal case. Is there such a thing as precedent in family court, or does that not apply? You mentioned that you see a family court judge kind of was more as a referee.
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. Actually, our entire legal system is predicated on statutes, which is laws deriving from legislators, okay, Harrisburg, if you will. And then the issue of case law, okay, precedent. So that's not just limited in terms of criminal law. It's in most certainly in family law. And those are the guidance, the law that the judge will look to in terms of trying to apply facts. There are different facts cases that the law is applied to that the court can use as guidance in a particular case before him or her.
Matt Fisher, by the way, is that the way your name is going to appear on the ballot?
Matt Fisher.
Matt Fisher.
It is. Yeah.
We appreciate you stopping in for a few minutes here today and letting our listeners get to know you a little bit.
Well, I appreciate the time and opportunity.
Sure. Election Day is May 21st.
It is.
And voters in Butler County will be making their choice for a judgeship to fill a vacancy on the Court of Common Pleas. We've been chatting with Matt Fisher here on this segment of It's Your Turn. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to be chatting, as I mentioned, with Deborah Stevens, who is actually one of four women who joined together to write this self-help book about empowerment for women. It's a pretty good book. It's called This Is Not the Life I Ordered. And we'll talk to Deborah Stevens here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Butler Health System is a top 100 hospital for getting Doug back to playing with his grandkids and managing his farm.
For ensuring that Craig made it to his daughter's college graduation.
For helping Ray travel to Europe to visit his family.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide nationally recognized care. But more importantly, we know why we have to.
Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Stacks of paperwork piling up around the house? Then let Accurate Solutions Group help get you started with spring cleaning. Simply bring anything you would like to have shredded to their office on South Eberhardt Road in Butler on Saturday, May 4th. Coffee and pastries will be provided, and all attendees will be entered to win a home office shredder. Accurate Solutions Group wants to help you shred through the clutter and start spring off right on Saturday, May 4th from 9 a.m. to noon. Investment advisory services offered through ASG Investment Management, LLC.
On the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. By the way, my name is Dave Malarkey. We're going to be talking about a self-help classic entitled This Is Not the Life I Ordered. And we have one of the co-authors of that book visiting with us on the telephone today. We say hello to Deborah Collins Stevens. Deborah, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
There are three other authors of this book. That's kind of tough. How did you get four women to sit down and write a book, or did it just develop?
It developed over 10 years, actually. We came together. We had been friends. We came together in crisis. My friend Janyana Hiro's husband was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Her children were three children under the age of 10. He was given 6 months to live. 3 weeks later, my friend Jackie Spears' husband was killed in a car accident. She was 6 months pregnant, and she had a child who was four. A month after that, my husband was diagnosed with a terminal illness. Being friends in the past, all at once, our lives changed forever. And it was Jackie Spear who said, we have to figure out a way to get through all of this, or it will affect our children. And so literally, we met around our kitchen table every week, brainstorming ways to get through a bad time. We researched, we invited people in to our kitchen table to speak with us, and this went on for 10 years. people said, oh, you should write a book about this. So we decided, yeah, we'll write a book. Well, we never did. And then one day I decided that it was getting embarrassing to say that we were writing this book, and it never appeared. So I took all of our notes. We went away for the weekend, and I came up with a draft of This Is Not the Life I Ordered.
Well, given the really tragic events that befell you, the group of you, we can understand the title, This Is Not the Life I Ordered, because certainly no one would anticipate these obstacles. This is a new edition. In fact, I hold it in my hand right now. I've got a review copy, a new edition with a new foreword, I understand, by Rita Moreno.
Yes, yes. I have to tell you, out of all the people I've interviewed, her life has been just extraordinary. Such a talented woman, but what people that I didn't know was all of the things she's overcome in her life. And she reached out to us in the first edition. We all became friends with her, and she's just an extraordinary woman. And so she wrote this foreword because our book reminded her so much of her own life.
Rita Moreno, maybe some of our younger listeners would not recognize that name. She was one of the original stars of West Side Story.
Yes, which is coming back. Steven Spielberg is producing a new version of West Side Story.
I did not know that. Maybe they'll give Rita a little cameo. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
She's going to be in it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, let's get to the meat and potatoes of your book here. You're talking about female solidarity, which is essential to the success of women and being able to cope with some of the things that you've dealt with.
Yes. In fact, there's research that we now know that females coming together and having bonding with friendship actually extends our lives. That's how important it is. And if you research the history of this, women have always come together. In the 1800s, they had quilting clubs where women sat around and created these beautiful quilts, but what they were actually doing was talking about their lives and coming up with ways to make them better for themselves and their children and their families.
Obviously, one of the things that you deal with in the book is handling grief and loss, as you indicated a few moments ago. What are some of the other things that you discuss? One of them is recovering from betrayal, right?
Yes, yes. Chandana Hero remarried. And after a very successful 28-year marriage to her deceased husband, she remarried. And unfortunately, it ended in divorce. And the sense of betrayal that she carried around for almost a decade was overwhelming for her. And so I asked her to put her thoughts and feelings down, because I think betrayal is an emotion that strikes women, and it's very, very difficult to overcome. So we included a chapter on it, and I found an extraordinary woman who taught me a lesson about this, and her name is Ava Kaur. She's all of 5 foot tall. She's in her 80s. However, she was one of the twins that was experimented on in the Holocaust. Mm. And every year, she returns to where she was imprisoned, and she reads letters to her tormentors where she has forgiven them. And it was so powerful to hear this. And so Jan and I decided that if she could forgive that, we could forgive anything. And I did some research on the whole concept of forgiveness. It is very healthy for you, and in fact, to not forgive hurts us more than helps us. It is not something easy to do. It takes practice, but it's something that is an antidote to betrayal.
You also offer guidance in your book, This Is Not the Life I Ordered. You also offer guidance on motherhood and raising kids.
Yes. All of our children were quite young when we encountered these tragedies. And one of the things that I think all mothers worry about is, are my kids going to be okay? All of our children are young adults now, and so in this edition, we decided to hear their stories. And we're here to tell you that the kids are okay. This is a very powerful chapter, and they talk about how they internalized what was going on in their lives. And the common theme was they're extraordinary children, but the wisdom that they have at their ages, and they're all in their late 20s or 20s, is really very powerful, and it came out of living in the circumstances that we didn't order.
Women, generally speaking, tend to be disadvantaged when we're talking about financial disadvantages compared to men. You talk about that in your book, do you not?
Yes, we do. This is something that it's been going on for years. Right now, if we continue on the track that we're on, it will be my great-great-granddaughter, should I have one, that will achieve parity in work and pay. The encouraging thing I see about this, although it's gone on for decades, is that the answer lies with fathers. Fathers are waking up to the fact that their daughters are being disadvantaged, and they don't like it. And many of them are in very powerful positions inside of corporations, and they've waken up to this fact, and they're taking, they're making a difference. And so it's women continuing to speak out on this issue, but men have a very important role to play.
By the way, the structure of your book, Deborah, includes section-by-section discussion questions called the WIT Kit, the W-I-T Kit. What's that all about?
It's called Women in Transition Kit. It's steps to take. When we came together, we were looking for action and tools. We end every chapter with what we call the WIT Kit, which are actions and tools that you can take to better the situation that you're in.
We need to take a quick break. We have a little bit more time to chat with our guest, Deborah Collins Stevens, one of the authors of This Is Not the Life I Ordered, new expanded edition. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the Me Too movement and some other stuff, too. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR, back after these words. Schnorr's Greenhouse, family-owned and operated since 1889. That's right, 1889. My goodness, they're celebrating 130 years in business. Very, very friendly service, very knowledgeable staff. If you're not quite sure what you're looking for, they'll be glad to help you out. At Schnorr's Greenhouse, they specialize in annuals, beautiful flowers, hanging baskets, vegetable plants, too. They have a tremendous selection from which to choose. I tell you what, not any flower you can imagine they've got it at Schnorr's Greenhouse. By the way, perfect stop for Mother's Day, too. It's just around the corner. Nice hanging basket or a potted plant for Mom. They have gift cards, too. So where are they located? Schnorr's Greenhouse off of Herman Road. Look for Schnorr Road near the RC Men's Club. Easy to find if you've never been there before. It's Butler's longtime trusted greenhouse since 1889. Schnorr's Greenhouse. They're open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, 8 a.m. to 5. Sunday, 11 to 5. Another one of our sponsors on the program today is Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. 126 years in business, Miller's Shoes. Headquarters, your local headquarters for SAS Comfort Shoes. About the most comfortable shoe you're ever going to wear. And with warm weather season now here and summer just around the corner, remember that SAS also makes sandals. And they're just as comfortable as their world-famous shoes. And they come in a variety of styles and colors, too. Try on a pair. maybe two, at Miller's Shoes. They're also your headquarters for athletic shoes for everybody in the family. They have all the famous name brands, Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPet, they got them all. For men, women, teens, kids. Miller's Shoes. You'll find a great selection. You'll find a good price. You'll find that famous Miller's Shoes fit. And a smile from the Ciprians, too. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR today, we are chatting with Deborah Collins Stevens, one of four women who wrote a book entitled This Is Not the Life I Ordered. Now, this book was published some time ago. There is a brand new, revised, updated, and expanded edition that is now out. And one of the things that you talk about that we didn't even know the term when the first edition of the book came out, the Me Too movement. What do you talk about there, Deborah?
Not only did we not know the term, we come from a generation who accepted that that was just the way the world worked. Jan talks about her first career in radio and television, where she was accosted by a producer, but she was told and she accepted that she had to find a way that just was part of the territory. The same thing happened with all of us, and we were of a generation that tried to find ways around it instead of confronting it because it was career limiting at the time. So what we write about is the courage of these young women who are coming forward and speaking about this issue, and bringing it out into the forefront. And there, and so it's, what we talk about is you don't have to accept it, and there are smart ways to deal with Me Too. And we interview other women and the ways in which they've dealt with it. Jackie Speier, who one of the co-authors, is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. And last year, she unveiled on national TV an issue that happened to her early in her career when she was an aide on Capitol Hill. And so I think it's encouraging, but it is being run by a generation of women who are much more courageous than we were.
You make a point to talk in your book about, you know, none of you were perfect. You all made mistakes. In fact, I'm searching through because I saw this earlier and I can't find it right now. There's a quick quote from Sophia Loren about making mistakes, something to the effect that making mistakes is part of living a full life or something like that. But you devote a whole chapter to this, correct?
Yes. Well, if you haven't made mistakes, you're probably not living a full life, and we have made a lot of them. And we talk about that openly in the book. But we also look to others. One great lesson that I learned was, she's deceased now, but she was a great corporate designer, one of the first women in America, and she invented Corningware. But what she was working on was for NASA, for a material that would be fireproof, and it didn't work. They did not work. So she looked at this pile of messes and said, what can we do with this? And her and her team created Corningware. And so what she taught us was that inside of every mistake lies a seed for something else. And so you have to accept that you're going to make mistakes and look for that seed. And we're perfect examples that you can always come back from a mistake.
Do you suggest that women try to find a couple or three friends, as you did, and be able to get together at least on a somewhat regular basis and talk about things?
Yes, we do, and we give guidelines for doing that. It might be the woman that you see in your office that you like. It might be the woman who you carpool with. It might be the woman in your neighborhood. To invite them, and it doesn't have to be fancy. We did it around our kitchen table. And to talk openly and honestly about your life, we had two rules. There was confidentiality. Whatever was said never left that kitchen. And secondly, that it never, ever became a pity party, because pity just doesn't help. So we go into depth about those guidelines. And one of the things that was wonderful in our first edition, we still get stories of women that have come together and are doing this and how it's helped their lives.
You talk about making courage an everyday companion. Expand on that a little bit, if you would, please, Deborah.
Well, courage is, there's this wonderful quote, courage is a muscle, and muscles only become stronger by getting a workout. And it's so to start with baby steps, to be courageous in addressing something in your life that needs to be addressed, becoming courageous to take a risk. One of the things that Jackie Speer always said that she told me this when I was 21 years old. She said, always take the risk. And I've passed that on to my daughter. It's to take a wise risk, and it takes courage to do that. I am so blessed that I have interviewed so many wonderful, courageous women, and it wears off. Their courage is contagious.
You have a chapter that deals with rebounding from mistakes and misery and mayhem. One of the things you suggest is schedule a paint date. What do you mean by that,
Deborah? This happened by accident. There was a woman in my neighborhood who was so persistent. She kept saying to me, you have to come to my garage with the other ladies from my church because we paint. And I kept putting her off until one day I just had to go. And I kept saying to her, I don't know how to paint. And she said, that doesn't matter. And what I found in that garage was a wonderful group of women of all different ages, and they had easels set up, and we painted. And so from a research basis, what we now know is when you're lost in creativity, it helps you overcome obstacles in your life, and it helps you to become healthier. And what I found in that garage was a generation, just different generations of women all coming together doing something creative, and the conversation was so helpful to me during a very difficult time in my life. And so that's what that chapter is about, looking for ways to, if you're in the middle of mayhem and crisis, there got to be escapes for you, even if it's only 10 or 15 minutes to find that. We have another example. You take a walk in the woods. We're now finding that in Japan, it is so powerful to be in a wooded area that doctors are actually writing prescriptions for it. There's something about that that's healing. So it's looking for those escapes.
One of your little subsections is entitled Trust in God, but Row Away from the Rocks. There can be a spiritual dimension to overcoming some of these problems, correct?
That's correct. For us, we certainly had that, each of us in our different ways. I can only speak for myself. I believe in God, a higher power, whatever you like to call it, and I've turned to that throughout my husband's long illness and then his death. One of the things that I've also learned, my doctor prescribed for me a meditation class. So I learned to meditate, and my mantra was, be still and know that there is God. And it really was quite helpful to me. So I think that no matter what your religion might be or what your beliefs, that is like a rock to hold on to during difficult times.
I am struck by the accessibility of your book. So many self-help books are just, you know, they're so abstract. It's just quite ridiculous. But I chuckle at some of your subchapters. Let yourself cry when Tinkerbell dies. Realize that Ozzy and Harriet are long gone. Be grateful the dog didn't pee on the carpet. I mean, oh, look at this one. Recognize that chocolate has to melt in order to take a new form. These are wonderful, accessible chapters, Deborah.
Well, thank you so very much. I'll tell you, this book, the first edition and the second edition, it was medicine for me. That's what it was. Because it forced me every day to connect with women who had overcome just insurmountable odds. And that was healing for me, and it gave me courage. And so I find it to be so blessed that I was able to be a part of this. And it was a good outcome for some very bad things that happened in our lives.
Listeners, this is the new, revised, updated, expanded edition of a self-help classic, This Is Not the Life I Ordered. It's just published this year in 2019, and it's been our pleasure to chat with one of the authors. There are four women who have told their stories in this book, and we've been chatting with Deborah Collins Stevens. Deborah, nice to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
It was very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for your time.
I much enjoyed. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We know that you consider your pet to be a member of your family. What better way to reinforce that feeling than by joining us at the 13th Annual Blessing of the Animals Ceremony and Pet Fair. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler invites you to bring your pet to our special ceremony to bless and honor our animal companions. This year, it's on Sunday, May 5th from 1:30 to 4:30 indoors at the General Butler Vagabond Center just above the fire hall in Lindora. Each pet will be individually blessed by an ordained minister. Bring a photo, collar, or an urn of your deceased pet to be remembered and blessed. But please, your pet should be well socialized around other pets. They should be on a lead or in a carrier. There's no charge. An animal chiropractor, a variety of new vendors, and an animal rescue organization will be on hand. A caricaturist will be there to sketch you and your pet. We'll have a Chinese basket auction to benefit Canine Companions for Independence. Join us. It's a great event. Blessings of the Animals, Sunday, May 5th at 1:30, rain or shine, indoors at the Vagabond Center in Lindora.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Listeners, we're going to be chatting on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And if you're just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visiting with us by telephone is Alvin Felsenberg. He's the author of a wonderful new book entitled A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. First of all, Mr. Felsenberg, welcome. Great to be able to talk with you for a few minutes here today, sir.
Wonderful to talk to you.
William F. Buckley, Jr., known by many. There's an upcoming generation, though. Gosh, I hate to think they would not have experienced this man, would they?
No, that's why I wrote it. I thought we could bring him back to them.
Yes.
I don't think they've lived in an era where we had such a civil person debating with the likes of every intellectual of his time in the most genial manner possible.
Yes, millennials and those younger, I mean, I suppose they could find some of his stuff on YouTube if they wanted to see him in action. But if they want to find out about his life, they should pick up a copy of your book because it's fascinating. You cover a sizable period in William F. Buckley's life. From when to when, Mr. Felsenburgh?
Well, he was born in 1925, and he left us in 2008, and I covered the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
From a brash young teenager who thought he had all the answers to all the world's problems and was supporting Charles Lindbergh's America First movement against FDR's attempts to shore up Britain during the Blitz, all the way to his election and influence on Ronald Reagan, where he significantly changed his views, as did Reagan, a former liberal Democrat, became a conservative Republican under Buckley's tutelage, through the George Bush era, really through the end.
Let's talk about his multimedia mastery. Many of our listeners will perhaps remember him from his work on PBS. We'll talk about that in a moment. But talk first, if you will, sir, about the National Review, because listeners may not be quite as familiar with that.
Well, first of all, he was an extraordinary communicator. He operated on multiple levels. When he left Yale University, he wrote a book called God and Man at Yale, which was an attack on what we now call political correctness that had been taking over the university. We can come back to that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
He was active in the anti-communist movement in the 50s and had the idea that he could set up a magazine that might bring all conservatives under one roof, where they could find out what other conservatives were thinking and writing and where conservative identifiers among the public might be reached. Hard to imagine that was the only magazine of its kind at the time. Respectful conservative point of view, did not have any touch of extremism or some of the things that the left always says about the right, whether they're extreme or not. But it had civil writing, it had great humor. But that was not all he did. I said operated on many levels. 5 years later, 1962, 5 years after starting the magazine, he was offered a syndicated column, called it On the Right, at a time where you just didn't do that. There were virtually no other conservative columnists of the time. So because of that, and because of his telegenic presence, he was invited on that new medium then, television, to debate the leading liberals of his time. So he's debating Schlesinger, Arthur Schlesinger, the historian, John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, Norman Mailer, the novelist, Garver Dahl, the playwright. Now, in our professional lives, we've all known people who punched above their weight, as we like to say. But that's a lot. He was doing the work of 20 people for the longest period. He was the only conservative recognizable on television, the only conservative columnist. That was not enough. He did 70 public appearances at universities a year. He wrote for sports magazines. He wrote for aviation magazines, wine magazines, cigar magazines, Esquire, even sat for a Playboy interview. So wherever you were, he found you, which really gets us to PBS. He was not only interested in talking to conservatives, he wanted to make converts, and he wasn't going to make converts among those who go to church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to find you on your boat and in your bar and in your dance, and even if you were not interested in politics, he would write for Esquire about social things and Truman Capote's mess ball, 1956. Well, but in the middle of that, he would squirrel the politics in. You'd get it. Now, this was an era before social media. This is an era before email. This was old technology, type and type and type away on his old Royal typewriter.
Listeners, a little bit about our guest, and if you've joined us a couple of minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn, that's fine. We're talking with Alvin Felsenburgh. He is the author of A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. So was Buckley always a conservative? Did he change in his approach to conservatism over the years? Talk about that, Mr. Felsenberg.
He changed in a lot of ways. Isolationism was the order of the day when he was growing up, which explains Lindbergh, mm-hmm. and explains the early period.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a great brander. He was a great promoter of his father's politics, which were isolationism. So at the age of 16, he was a master sailor. His parents bought him his first sailboat. So what did he call it? Sweet Isolation. Knowing every time he won a ribbon, his father's views would be in the story. And World War II, of course, changed that. He realized in a hostile world with dictators determined to impose their will on the planet, maybe that view had to yield. And after the war, he became a rather strong anti-communist and a firm interventionist. So he changed his views. He also changed conservatism. In the early days, he wrote some editorials that are hard to read for the 21st century orientation. He not only opposed the Brown versus Board of Ed decision, which mandated separate and equal, but were unconstitutional on the face of it, but he also said that whites should rule because they were the superior race. That's the part that's hard to take. You could argue the first part of unconstitutional grounds.
Mm-hmm.
But as the 60s progressed, and as the resistance to civil rights became extremely vitriolic and violent, and the rise of what he called the welfare populace, people like George Wallace, who only opposed federal intervention when African Americans were the beneficiaries of it, but were perfectly happy to take every Great Society program to build up the budget of Alabama, and were very incendiary in their rhetoric, and we'd call it race baiting as a method of campaigning. He changed his mind considerably on that. A turning point was the 1963 Birmingham bombing of a black church where four little girls in their Sunday best were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He really began to rethink his views that if the South was going to be, in those days, that impenetrable, that resistant, and that violent, then there was perhaps no alternative to federal intervention. He came around on that. He broke with conservatives on several things. He was one of the early ones to say that juvenile sentencing was unfair, that blacks had a higher number of incarcerations compared to whites who committed the same crime. He believed in free markets and competition. When he ran for mayor, he was an early promoter of what listeners would know as Uber today.
Yes.
He couldn't understand why a person with a clean driving record and a good reputation couldn't rent spaces out in his car to passengers willing to pay for a ride. Well, it's not a fair jump from that to Uber. He's one of the first to talk about school choice, although in those days he called it vouchers for parents, middle-class parents who were struggling to send their children to parochial school.
Let me ask you about presidents, because our time begins to run short here. Your schedule
sure.
is very tight.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan was his favorite president. He broke with George Bush, however, over the Iraq War.
Yep.
What do you think Bill Buckley would think of Trump if Buckley were still alive?
We have a couple of ideas. If Trump carries through and cleans out the swamp with special interests, people who are here to lobby for their own selfish gains, that he would cheer it on. But he was very concerned about separation of power, whoever the president was. He felt Congress should be an assertive co-partner to the president, that the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader were not presidential aides, always commenting on a presidential program, but had an agenda of their own that they would compromise with the president to enact. Separation of powers, constitutional checks, were very important to Buckley. He was very weary of what he called the cult of personality, which he had seen rise as a young man in Europe and other places. So I think it'd be mixed, and he certainly would support anything that lowered marginal tax rates, which he saw as a way of spurring economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the president's talked about 4% as a goal. That's pretty much where we were in the Reagan years. We actually did a little better with that, but we clearly have to do better than where we are. We're at 1.5%, 2%. That's very anemic for a country this size.
I'm sure there are young people today, whether they're millennials or even younger, who, when we talk about conservatives and liberals discussing things, their only model is the screaming and yelling that we see well, let's take two, Fox News and MSNBC. They would have no idea of the intellectual and rational and calm the debates. But I can remember when I was coming of age, discovering Firing Line on PBS and being fascinated by this gentleman. Totally different from what we see today on TV.
Well, he wanted to make converts on the other side. That was so great about the show, because you were turning in, and others with a liberal perspective were turning in, and they had to watch the same show. Sometimes their own opinions were challenged, sometimes reaffirmed. But let me end with, our public people don't have a sense of humor anymore. They don't have a tremendous set of wit. Imagine a man running for mayor of New York, and what would you do if you win was the question, demand a recount was the answer. He admired great wits of the 19th century. He read the speeches of some great senators. He very much admired Adlai Stevenson and John Kennedy, not for their politics, but because of their humor. He gave conservatism a happy face. George Will said that Bill Buckley had the smile that could light up an auditorium. I can attest to the validity of that. I've seen it many, many times.
I saw it on TV, it's true.
When he made the cover of Time, the headline wasn't William F. Buckley Jr., conservative writer. The headline was William F. Buckley Jr., : conservatism can be fun. The fun has left politics these days, and that's what I think our millennials have been, they don't even know they've been robbed of it by the slugfest nature of our politics, everything being reduced to a soundbite, and people tuning in just to get reaffirmed. Reaffirmation of what they thought before they turned it on. That's not education. That's not civic responsibility.
Let me close with...
You would be saddened by that.
Let me close, listeners, with two testimonials. One, and you might well expect George F. Will, who really loved Mr. Felsenberg's book. They both loved language, very much so. But here's a testimonial that might surprise you from Chris Matthews, host of Hardball on MSNBC, who talked about in his testimony, in high school, I searched drugstores for each new issue of National Review. It was that important. He loved your book as well. He must have been pleased to get that testimonial, sir.
I was honored because, again, Chris wanted to see what Buckley was saying about his own views. I mean, he was a young Democrat at the time. He would go on to work for Speaker O'Neill after Jimmy Carter. And if Bill Buckley was challenging them, they better find an answer. But even as a young teen, he was very interested in ideas. Well, if you can get that kind of respect from the other side, which Buckley clearly did, that's a sign of his lasting achievement. I wish some people today leave that kind of legacy. We'll see. We have to get back to that somehow.
The title of the book is A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr., by our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn, Alvin Felsenberg. Thank you, sir. Nice to talk with you today. Thanks so much.
It was a great pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby is not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler. Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.